All right, everyone. It's that time of the hour. You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. And tonight on Right On Radio, Liz Olds talks with Naomi Hirahara about her book, Clark and Division, a mystery set in the Japanese America of Chicago during World War II, with emphasis on the effects the camps had on families in that community. In the last part of the hour, we'll be featuring a special legacy episode. You will hear an interview from deep within the Right On Radio archive from long ago. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Naomi, are you there?
I sure am.
Great. Why don't we start with that little synopsis of the book and the reading?
Sure. Clark and Division, which, by the way, is an intersection in Chicago where a lot of Japanese Americans moved to after being incarcerated in one of the 10 camps during World War II. So the book is about two things. It's about sisterhood, and it's also about a Japanese-American family, the Ito family. And the older daughter is Rose, and the younger daughter is Aki, and she idolizes her older sister. And they, from Los Angeles, they are sent to Manzanar Detention Center during World War II. And then through an early release program, Rose is able to go to Chicago. Several months later, Aki, and the book is told from Aki's point of view, Aki and her parents follow, only to discover something tragic has happened to Rose. And now it's up to Aki, the younger sister, to find out what happened, as well as to carry her immigrant parents through this chaotic period of their lives. So that's essentially the synopsis. And so I'll do a very brief reading. And this is the family, the Aki and her parents are on their way to Chicago on the train. When I returned to our seats, most of my makeup was on my handkerchief as I cleansed my face with some cold water. Pop had already fallen asleep, the brim of his hat lowered over his eyes. Sticking out from the band was the edge of the paper, now completely yellowed, that listed the location of our earthly belongings in Los Angeles. "I wonder if Rose will meet us at the station," Mom said. We hadn't heard from Rose for a couple of weeks. I had sent her a telegram with our Chicago arrival date, but didn't receive a response back. We weren't worried at the time. It wasn't like she could call us in camp. Mom suspected Rose was lovesick about some young man in the city. On the train, we saw Nisei GIs, handsome in their pressed uniforms, and I imagined that someone like that had captured Rose's heart. As we got closer to our destination, I could tell Pop was getting excited. He was sitting straight up as the train lurched back and forth. He kept looking out the window and back toward the passengers leaving and entering. Oh, to see the flash of Rose's smile, that in itself would be enough for me. When we finally arrived at Union Station, Pop was the first out the door with his one suitcase. The train station was so huge and grand, with majestic white-colored marble walls. A huge war bonds poster was on display below the clock, while the flags of military allies, the United States, Great Britain, France, and Australia, hung down by the vertical beams. In the center of the station was a USO desk to serve all the soldiers who were on leave and needed instructions on the best accommodations and recreation. As we stumbled into this mess in humanity, we saw a group of Japanese Americans walking toward us. I recognized one of our former Nisei camp leaders, Ed Tamura. Ed had hightailed out of Manzanar as soon as he could. His face was round and smooth. If he had to shave every day, I would be surprised. Then I spotted Roy and his slick back hair drooping a bit in the May heat. I first felt embarrassed that there was this welcome party for us. We were simply the Itos, a former Los Angeles produce manager, his wife, and younger daughter. I searched the group for my sister, but there was no bright smile. Lipstick applied perfectly in spite of the humidity. Something's happened. I could barely hear Mr. Tamura's voice over the hubbub in the building. Roy couldn't look at us. There was an accident at the subway station last night, he said. Before he could declare, she's dead, I knew. I had felt it in my bones when I was getting sick on the train. Rose had departed this earth as dramatically as only she could have done.
Thank you. That is Naomi Hirahara with a reading from Clarkham Division, her new book. You know, it's part mystery and part history, and I was wondering if we could unpack the history first because it's such an important part of the book. The World War II generation is dying off, and I think the memories of the internment camps are dying off as well. And there's some people who don't even know about the internment camps, which I think is terrible. I think that needs to be remembered. And I was wondering if you could tell us something about those camps, how they came about and how people got taken to them and what it cost the Japanese American community.
Yeah, I mean, on February 19th, 1942, that's when President Roosevelt signed the executive order, 9066, and that pretty much made it possible for the Japanese Americans to be incarcerated in this way without any trial, hearing, you know. And it was, you know, later on they had these handbills that were put up all throughout places on the West Coast, and it said, you know, aliens and non-aliens. You know, that they had to report to some kind of place and then be sent to one of these 10 camps. There was one in California, two in California, Manzanar, and one that was close to the Oregon border. And there was, you know, they ranged from, you know, the West Coast to all the way to Arkansas. And there were a total of 120,000 people that were in these camps, and one-third of them were American citizens. They were born, like Aki and her sister Rose, they were born here. And in 1988, the U.S. government, they passed and signed, the President Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Bill, which pretty much said, you know, the nation apologized for this travesty. You know, there was no report of espionage or any of that kind of thing. And there was also a monetary restitution for the individuals who had been in these camps. So pretty much, you know, it was established that this was the wrong thing to do, that it was because of a lack of political leadership. And there was also you know, hysteria, as well as, and there was some greed involved too, because many Japanese Americans on the West Coast, they were kind of the leaders in agriculture, and their, you know, farms and fishing operations were taken away. So, you know, that happened in 1942, and some people were in camp, you know, even past the war, 1946, because they had no place to go. But, you know, the younger ones, the Nisei, the second generation born here, there were, you know, special release programs for them to leave early because the government didn't necessarily want to, you know, pay for all these people in camp. But they had to go inland, you know, and so Chicago was the number one destination. It was the second biggest city in the United States at the time. It had a lot of industry there. So it's ironic because many of these Nisei worked in like defense factories. So, you know, if the government's saying that this is a seditious, these are seditious people, why are you sending them to, you know, defense and factories to work? But so, yeah, so Chicago before World War II had 400 people. And by the 1940s, there were 20,000. Because the first to go there were young and they were without any parental supervision, actually many of them, not all, but some of them got into trouble. And in fact, so much so that a resettlers group in the 1940s, they were kind of concerned about the juvenile delinquency. There was a report that I saw, because I also co-wrote a nonfiction book on this topic that talked about, you know, babies being born out of wedlock, abortions, which were illegal at the time, and other various crimes. So when I saw that report, since I'm a mystery writer, I got very interested. And then when I went back to look at, like, oral histories, I saw that people were kind of talking around the problems, the societal problems that were happening in the community. So I thought, okay, that's my place then as a mystery writer to kind of imagine and fill in the blank spaces.
How did they decide who got the early release? I know Rose got the early release first, and then her family came after. How did they decide?
Well, you had to be willing to do it, and you had to apply, you know, go through interviews. There was some, you know, and of course, if you were considered more patriotic, you know, if you had some kind of criminal record, and there's in Clark and Division, there's all sorts of characters, and one of them is like a young man named Hammer, who's a little bit of a hoodlum. You know, he wears a zoot suit around, and he is in Chicago, not through the early release program, but because he had done something criminal in camp. He was sent to Boys Town in Nebraska, you know, where Father Flanagan was, and then he broke out of there to go to Chicago. So it was, you know, type of thing where, you know, there was also an active program to get Nisei, who were like college bound, to go to universities within like the Midwest and the East Coast. So, but, you know, many of those schools had quotas. So it wasn't like a bunch of Nisei could go to one school. You know, they would accept like one or two Nisei students. So they were kind of scattered. So I think the government also wanted assimilation for, you know, maybe they thought that would be the solution to deal with Japanese Americans, is to have them kind of erased or disappeared throughout the nation. And of course, in a place like Chicago, they told them, you know, do not congregate in numbers three or more, but, you know, you arrive, you're a newcomer to this town, you know, big city, and you can't find housing. Of course, you're going to rely on, you know, your people, your family members, your former neighbors. So that kind of erasure in terms of population, people congregated still, but there's no physical remains. There's not a quote Japan town that's in Chicago. So I think, you know, this kind of history is new to a lot of people because they're, you know, physically you don't, you know, see anything from that particular era that kind of marks this type of diaspora.
Tell us some about Aki. She idolizes her sister. She has lived through living in L.A. as just kind of an average person, being taken to these camps, having her family's business basically stolen from them, living in the camp, and then she kind of has to be the person who helps her parents get used to Chicago. And tell us a little bit more. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to do any spoilers, but you can tell how much you choose. So tell us about Aki.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I kind of gravitate towards ordinary people or people who are underestimated. And what's funny is actually I'm the older sister and my brother is like 8.5 years younger than me. I don't have a sister. So there was like, I did have to use my imagination as well as my relationships with my girlfriends who are the younger sister. And I had to even interview some of them to fully understand what it's like to be in the shadow of, you know, someone greater in your family. And in the beginning of the book, it starts off actually with the birth of Aki, you know, as people have told her what happened. And you don't even know Aki's name, you know, for a few pages. It's more Rose, her sister, who's 3 years old, and she takes center stage at her younger sister's birth and tugs at her leg, you know. And so it kind of signifies that Aki always feels like she's not, you know, center stage, yet she has been born like a breech birth. So it's kind of a sign like she actually is unusual, and she, in her heart of hearts, she is a truth teller. Mm-hmm. And I think her parents, you know, in order to survive this very difficult time in their lives, they, especially her mother, wants to focus on the future, you know, and not look behind them and not look at their losses. But because Rose has died, you know, under kind of suspicious circumstances, Aki can't accept that, you know, and she feels for her to go forward, she has to figure out, you know, what happened, even though, you know, her parents are saying, drop it, let's forget it, you know, for now. And even people around her in the community, they don't want to delve into kind of the sadness or trauma that they've experienced. But I think, you know, Aki actually has this enormous strength of character, even though it's unseen. It slowly begins to come out, and she kind of finds her voice through the course of the book.
She's very loyal to Rose, and she wants the truth to come out about what happened to Rose. She doesn't even know what the truth is, but she wants the truth to come out, and she works very hard at that. And sometimes it isolates her, and sometimes it alienates her from people, even her parents. And could you talk some about the things that, the ways that she gets isolated and alienated from both her parents and other people in the Japanese-American community?
Well, I mean, I think in this way, I kind of do relate to Aki in the sense that she's a Nisei. My mother is from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of understand, like, the cultural, there's this value of saving face, you know, and you don't want to stick out. You don't want people to be talking. I mean, I think that's, you know, all people. You don't want to be the center of gossip. But I think, you know, there's the family pretty much values certain cultural practices. Like, there's this thing called koden, where when someone dies, everybody gives money to help mm-hmm. with the funeral expenses. And that's sort of part of that ritual is done, you know, in the Ito family, you know, at Rose's death. But as Aki finds more and more about the condition of Rose when she died, and she kind of brings it up to her family's attention, they're just like, okay, you know, they're pretty much saying, just drop it. Just, you know, don't try to pull out anything more. Let's just go on, you know. So, and wherever Aki goes, you know, to some family friends who have also relocated to Chicago, you know, people are kind of telling her the same thing, you know, you don't really know, you know, just forget about it, Aki, and go on with your life. And I really respect that. And I mean, it's kind of funny because I'm talking about a fictional character, but I respect that about Aki, because I think in the long run, her that she wants to go forward in her life with truth, you know, rather than negating or ignoring things that have happened. I think it'll serve her well, you know, later in life. But and she's young, you know, she's in her early 20s during most of the action that goes on in the book.
This is intense mystery and intense history. Very, I really enjoyed the book. It's very intense. And I'm wondering if you found it painful or difficult or inspiring, or how you felt as you were writing the book.
It was it was difficult. And then I was doing part of the writing and all of the rewriting during the pandemic. But some of it, you know, just, because we're, you know, right now we're kind of in confinement, depending on how active you are. But just the feeling that Aki has, you know, when she goes to Chicago, and she's just for the past couple of years, she's used to being in a confined space, you know, in the desert with other Japanese Americans. And then, you know, away from stores, you know, mainstream stores and all that kind of thing. And all of a sudden, she's in the, you know, Chicago, and she doesn't quite know how to act. And I think that's how I felt, you know, off and on during the pandemic, you know, when things open up and it's like, how do I greet people? You know, what do I do? So I think that those kind of elements actually kind of helped me to connect with Rose's situation. But yeah, it was, there were times that it was, there was trauma, you know, it's very traumatic. But I think my own family history, my immediate family, they weren't incarcerated, but they were in Hiroshima during World War II. So they're atomic bomb survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me personally, many things I write about are difficult. However, there's always, I feel, a glimmer of hope. And I think that's something, you know, my parents, especially my father, kind of instilled in me. And the importance of family and the importance, you know, of laughter and supporting one another during hard times, I think. That's something I personally learned, and I think it just can't help but to come out in the things I write.
Well, there's definitely hope in the book. I felt that very strongly. Excuse me. I'm wondering, God, I have so many questions to ask. Well, let's go back to some history, and it does play a role in the book. Many of the Japanese American men actually served in the United States Armed Forces, and I'm wondering how they kind of coped with that, knowing that they had been there had been basically a war crime against them, and now they were serving in the armed forces. I mean, how did that affect the Japanese American community?
You know, they were kind of divided about that, because at first, when after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the government declared Japanese Americans, like, they were classified as enemy aliens, so they couldn't serve in the armed forces. Although there were many people who were able, I don't know, it was not practiced across the board, that particular policy. But it was actually Japanese Americans who had lobbied this one man named Mike Masaoka of the Japanese American Citizens League. He really wanted Nisei men to be able to serve, you know. And so some people supported him. Some people disliked that because they felt like they were on like a suicide mission to kind of prove their loyalty. So, but yeah, so some people resisted the draft, and they were sent to prison because of that. So it's very interesting. But my own father-in-law served with the 100th for 42nd Regimental Combat Team, and he fought in Europe and was injured. So I think that part of the story, you know, through my husband's family, I could relate to, as well as many other, you know, Nisei men I knew who had served. And, you know, they were the, per capita, they were the most decorated military group during World War II. They had, you know, sustained a lot of fatalities and injuries. So, I mean, that's one thing. When I was interviewed on another podcast, it was like someone from New York, and they had no idea that the Nisei men were drafted or, you know, from camp. So that was kind of news to them. To me, what's so tragic is when they were killed in battle, and there were some funerals that were actually held in camp, you know, behind barbed wire. Mm. And I just can't imagine what their parents, you know, how they suffered during that loss while they were, you know, incarcerated.
We are almost running out of time, and I have so many questions, but let's do this one. I learned so much from this book. I knew a little bit beforehand, but I learned a great deal from this book, and I'm wondering how you feel about fiction as a teaching tool. The book was no way pedantic. I mean, it wasn't like that, but I learned so much. So how do you feel about fiction as a teaching tool?
I think it could be super effective because, you know, and I say I tell lies to tell the truth. Mm. And then I think also, like, when you're, I've written quite a few nonfiction books as well, and I think there is great value to putting actual names, you know, to people, real names. But I think when you're talking about, like, difficult situations, you know, brokenness in a family, somehow, you know, I find it more freeing to work in the fictional realm, but the truth of those interactions, that's there, you know. And somehow I feel like I could tackle these issues easier in the fictional world, you know, whereas if you did it in nonfiction, people would be pointing fingers of blame or shame, you know. And I think by writing a story like this in the fiction, I could avoid those kind of things.
Well, we have run out of time. I could talk to you all night long about this, but we have covered a lot, so I'm glad. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Naomi Hirahara, author of Clark and Division, I highly recommend it. And thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking some time to be on Right on Radio tonight.
Thank you for having me, Liz.
Okay, we'll let you go. Goodbye.
Before he was called the Wonderling, he had many names: Puddlehead, Plonker, Groundling, and Spike, among others. He didn't mind these much, not even Groundling. The name he truly disliked was the first he ever remembered being called, Number 13. It wasn't a name, really, just a number written in red on a piece of paper, filed in a drawer in a room full of hundreds of files and drawers. It was embossed on a small tin medallion attached to a piece of cord he wore around his neck at a home for unclaimed creatures. It was sewn inside his tattered gray shirt and shabby gray trousers, and it was painted on his hard, narrow bed in a room full of the beds of other unclaimed creatures who had at least been fortunate enough to have been given the gift of birth. He looked like a young fox, but stood upright like a child and had no tail to speak of. His eyes were a lovely chestnut brown and flecked with gold. But there was something about them that gave one the sense that although he had not been in this world very long, he carried within him some inexplicable sorrow. He was a creature with an innocent heart. What kind of creature, though? Who could say? Despite his fox kit face, his snout was more dog than fox, and there was something rabbity about him, too, in the way his nose twitched when he sensed danger, and how he trembled when he heard the loud clang of the orphanage bell. But the most singular thing about him was that he had only one ear.
Very good. You've been listening to Mira Bartok reading from her new children's novel, The Wonderling. She is the author of numerous books, including The Memory Palace, a memoir, which won the 2011 National Book Critics Circle Award for Autobiography. And The Wonderling, I understand, is going to be made into a film, so that's great, too. Mira Bartok, welcome to Write on Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, tell us a little bit about the story. I mean, it's sort of, in many ways, a fantasy homage to Oliver Twist, I guess.
Well, it's a kind of a mashup of several things.
Yeah,
right. Definitely I was influenced by Dickens and the world he created, particularly Oliver Twist, but there are other other influences in there, too. But there are also... I was definitely influenced by the classic children's stories and young adult stories like Lord of the Rings and and obviously the Narnia books and by C.S. Lewis and so I wanted to have this to have a classic feel.
Yeah.
But it's a world that feels kind of Victorian England during the Industrial Revolution, which is a time in England that, as well as United States and other places, that seems to resonate with a lot of the things that are going on now in our world.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely is a fantasy.
Yeah. So we start off with him, with Arthur, who you talk about as number 13 and who later gets the name Arthur, in this orphanage.
Right. He's in this horrible place that is called Miss Carbuncle's Home for Wayward and Misbegotten Creatures, and it's run by our villainess named Miss Carbuncle, who has a very mysterious history of her own, and you find out a lot more about her throughout the book, and she will definitely be in book two, which I'm in the middle of writing right now. She has a 2.5 foot high bright orange wig, which she is concealing something underneath, which I won't tell you about. You'll have to read the book. But she is sort of an example of someone who had a lot of disappointment in early life, and that transformed into bullying and general bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
She's very much a kind of dictator sort of character.
Yeah.
But he does escape. That's not a spoiler. It's on the cover of the book, so everyone knows. Arthur escapes, number 13 escapes, and sets off to find his destiny.
Yeah.
And goes on a lot of adventures.
So in many ways, it's a coming of age story, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, he turns 11 in the beginning of the book, and I love that age because, and I like writing for that age a lot. I think, you're not concerned about hormones and romance, really. You're really concerned about, who the main characters are, who am I in the world? And everything is so wondrous and, and who are my friends and why am I here? And, he asks all these questions, and those are the kind of questions I remember asking myself when I was 11.
Sure. Where did the inspiration for him come from? And was it was there any one person that a nephew or something, or was it just sort of a conglomeration, or was it just sort of an idealized 11-year-old in your mind?
A combination. I think the character in some ways is a lot like I was when I was 11. Mm. I was pretty shy and had certain gifts, but I was afraid to share them. So it's a little, there's a little bit of me in there, but also I often start writing about a character through drawing, just random drawing and sketching whatever comes to my mind, or being out in the world and sketching, particularly sketching animals. And so my character started out as a sketch, And I wasn't even thinking about who this character was. I just started sketching, and I made a drawing of actually a one-eared rabbit, which turned into a fox dog-like creature that looks somewhat like my own dog, Sadie. She's black, but she has these giant ears, and I also wanted, I knew that I wanted a character that had, like in great, a lot of folk tales, there's a lack and a gain, and in this case, it seems like my character would have, he only has one ear, he doesn't know why he's born, was he born that way, did he lose it in some way, so he has this lack, but yet he has this incredible gift that you find out about that he uses his ear for.
Yeah, I don't think it's giving too much away to talk about that. But I mean, if you don't want to, we certainly don't have to. But it is sort of often the case that when we lose something, a sense of smell, a sense of taste, a sense of hearing or whatever, we gain. We don't necessarily gain on the other side, but we become much more attuned to those other senses and we're able to use them better. And so
definitely.
So there's just sort of this compensatory process that nature seems to endow us with.
Yeah, I definitely see that with my dog. She's getting old and she's losing her sense of hearing and sight. So she's paying a lot more attention to the world with her nose, even though, of course, dogs do that.
Yeah.
She sniffs a lot more. She sniffs around to find things much more than she used to.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. And you mostly populate the story with these hybrid creatures. I mean, you talk a little bit about 13 Arthur, who is sort of a part fox, part person, and most of the characters, there's a few that are not, of course, but I mean, there are many within the story, but a few of the ones that you sort of focus on are not. But by and large, they're all these hybrids. Talk a little bit about the decision to do that.
I knew that I wanted to have animals in this book. And one of the really basic reasons was I enjoy drawing them so much more than I enjoy drawing people. And I'm just better at it. And I also love animals. I used to work at a zoo. I spend a lot of time, as much as time as I can, you know, around animals. I visit a horse every day that lives down the road. I have a dog. I used to live on a farm with more animals. And so that was part of it. But also, I wanted there to be a kind of hierarchy and in my world. And I knew that I'm not sure why I wanted to have an animal-human hybrid. I think it just sort of popped into my mind, and that's what happened. And I knew that I wanted there to be animals and then these animal-human hybrids that are called groundlings, and then the humans. But also there are other creatures that are creatures of ancient magic that appear. And those, we learn a little bit more about them in book two, and they, some of them transform into other things. And so there's definitely this hierarchy, and the humans really dominate these groundlings and treat them poorly. So I think that it's just part of this class system I created. They're not supposed to be, you know, specifically supposed to represent any group of people that exist, you know, in our world, other than just think of anyone who is treated poorly in our society, and they can be a groundling.
Yeah. Right. And you also did all the illustrations yourself as well. You talk about loving to draw and so forth. This book kind of reminded me a little bit of the Monster Blood Tattoo series, and particularly Lamplighter by D.M. Cornish.
I don't know those. Wait a minute. I have to write those down.
Oh, okay.
The Monster Blood
tattoo series. Yeah.
Okay.
One of the books. The only one that I got to interview him for the show was called Lamplighter, which was book two in the series. And it's essentially a very similar story in some ways, this young orphan. And he does all his own illustrations. He's an author illustrator. I think he's Australian. And it was a number of years ago we had him on the show. But he had, it's been so many years, I can't recall, maybe 100 pages of illustrations that he had put forth. And then he had to cull from them for the book, you know. Didn't use all that many within the text itself, but it was just interesting to talk to somebody who was able to do illustrations as well as writing, because in children's literature that's pretty rare. Was that something that you knew right off the bat you're going to be able to do this, or did you have to talk to your publisher and say, I want to be allowed to do this, or?
Normally with children's books, And this is true with, when people are, they're writing their first picture book, say picture books for, younger children. Mm-hmm. The rule is don't illustrate your own book. A newbie writer always feels like they have to turn in illustrations too to get it accepted. And that's like the worst thing to do, because usually one of those things you do better.
Yeah.
That is true that middle grade authors rarely illustrate their own work. That's very, I didn't realize that was so unusual, but it is. In this case, when my agent submitted my manuscript, which was only about a quarter of the way done, I had done some finished illustrations.
Mm.
And she submitted those as well.
Okay.
Because she felt that they were as strong and they were integral to the book. And when my publisher saw them, she and the art director really loved them, and that was definitely part of the book deal. They automatically wanted me to illustrate the book too. And the movie was actually sold partially because of these images. The movie agents who initially happened to see my manuscript, which was a total fluke. It was just one of those weird moments where someone's in the right place at the right time. my agent is crazy. I mean, this stuff doesn't happen. It's just weird. My agent was in a meeting at in LA for another project for another client, and she happened to have my manuscript opened up on her laptop at this meeting at CAA, which is Creative Artists Agency, the big movie agency, and she had one of my illustrations of Arthur right there, and the movie agents happened to pass by and said, "What's that?"
Mm.
And it was based on that drawing.
Wow.
To answer your question in a roundabout way, it is very unusual. I didn't know if they were going to let me illustrate it or not.
Yeah.
But that was just a given. That was immediately a green light. I also had like this author you're talking about. I also had a lot more of illustrations that didn't get into the book because they're just, it's a big book.
Yeah.
It's really kind of fat and turned out to be longer than I anticipated.
Right.
So we ended up ditching some of those big illustrations and just, I ended up making a bunch of little spot illustrations to fit in spaces.
Yeah, well, that's sort of more common with this age of reader anyway, I think. You don't see as many of the bigger illustrations. So, well, let's listen, if we can, to another passage from the book.
Okay, then. Let's see here. Let me find a page. I think I'll read... I'll read a little, this is a little section when you learn about his special gift.
Okay.
And he is, number 13, who will become Arthur, is in the dining hall at the home, this horrible orphanage. And he's sitting down, and he's very, very shy. And anyway, he's just sort of sitting there eating his cold porridge. The one-eared orphan longed for companionship, but whenever he gathered the courage to approach someone, he spoke so softly and stuttered so much that it was hard to understand him. Some of the groundlings, not to mention the headmistress and Mr. Sneezeweed, her assistant, treated him as though he were deaf. How could that stammering creature called number 13 possibly hear with just one pathetic ear? But he was listening. He was listening to everything around him. If he concentrated hard enough and went to a quiet, secret place inside himself, he could sometimes hear extraordinary things. He could hear the secret movements of insects busy at their work beneath the floorboards and inside the walls, and he wondered if they could hear him too. He could hear the old donkey in the stables softly braying itself to sleep at night, and the two carriage horses swatting flies with their tails in summer. He had never seen them, but he knew they were there. And in winter, he could even hear snow falling in the courtyard. The worst weather produced the loveliest of sounds. Whoosh, whoosh. And he wondered if this was a kind of song, this melody of snow. And if by chance in spring, a bird, small and delicate of wing, was singing in the tree outside the wall, number 13 could hear her clear as a bell from inside the home. He could hear the quiet snap of every twig, the gentle flutter of her wings as she flew from branch to branch. Loveliest of all, he could hear her tender nesting song as she soared through the air to her new home. And when he did, her song filled him with such unbearable longing, he thought his swollen heart would burst.
Very good. That is Mira Bartok reading from her new children's novel, The Wonderling. And you're listening to Right on Radio on KFAI. One of the things that I found interesting was the importance of music. I mean, you talk about it much more later in the book than you do earlier in the book, because earlier in the book you're sort of telling us who these people are and what's going on. But then it becomes much more important as the book progresses, and I imagine will be very important in book two as well.
Yes. My character, you know, he lives in this place until he escapes, where music is forbidden, and the worst crime of all is to sing. And yet, in his sleep, he starts singing. He can't help himself, and you learn more about that as time goes on, and more about his musical gifts, and the. You know, the book is called The Wonderling, but the subtitle is Song Catcher, which is a machine that contains the most beautiful music and songs and sounds in the world. And that becomes a really important sort of wondrous device that number 13/Arthur discovers. And yes, music is so important, and expressing oneself and the and our young hero's imagination, which has been stifled in this place, and it definitely is important in book two. Book two is called Singing Tree, and music takes on a whole other power in a kind of a larger way. I can't give anything away,
but no.
definitely there's music, and a couple of the characters, you know, like there's one character is very much like a combination of Fagin and the Artful Dodger named Quintus.
Right.
He's always making up songs singing music, very important.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking about that as I was coming up with questions, that I was trying to decide if Quintus was more like Fagin or more like the Artful Dodger, and I just decided he was a combination of the both of them.
Right.
And one of the other things that you do is you've created this world, of course. You've got Lumentown and Gloomentown, and this whole world, but you kept the Arthurian legend, the Arthurian mythology. And I was curious about the decision-making process, you know, what led you to decide to keep certain elements of our past mythology and at the same time create this completely different sort of world? Was it just a fascination with that particular story?
I think that this may sound really silly because I wasn't raised with TV, and so I kind of miss a lot of cultural cues. And I live in a small town and a very rural area in a very rural area where we don't have high speed internet, and so. Whatever I watch, I either, you know, get DVD movies or once in a while I get a television series. And I discovered this television series that was on this, I guess, Sci-Fi channel a while back called Merlin.
Yeah.
It's with the Irish young actor Cullen Morgan plays young Merlin. It's a fantasy, and it's about if Merlin was young, not this old bearded dude, wizard, and he gets to know young Arthur as a young man before he becomes a king, what would happen? And I fell in love with the series, and I fell in love in particular with the young Merlin. I watched the show, all the episodes before I wrote The Wonderling, and that's kind of what made me decide to mess around with the Arthurian legend, because they take various Arthurian tropes in the show and they just play with them and do really interesting things. And there are many ways to tell the story, but I think that at its heart, what captivated me was the idea of this character who is pure of heart, and who, you know, kind of like a babe character, who because of his innocence and his goodness, his essential goodness, he's able to transform situations. He's able to do good things, you know, amazing things. You know, of course, you don't see his sort of power as much until you see that more in book two, let's say.
Yeah.
But in this television series, Merlin was that kind of character, and that just and seeing that series, I think, reminded me of all those books and movies that I loved, where there is this character who saves the day, not necessarily by fighting, you know, and having a big battle with people, you know, being a kind of warrior character, but rather someone who sings?
Yeah. Well, it was
who touches our heart.
Yeah, it was great. We're out of time, so we're going to have to leave it at that. But I really liked it, and I look forward to seeing reading book two as well when that comes out. This is Steve McElstrom speaking with Mira Bartok about her new children's novel, The Wonderling. Mira Bartok, thanks for being on Right on Radio.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks so much. Yeah. It's great to be here.
All right, great. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM, Radio Without Boundaries, and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. Also, you can listen on the KFAI app on your smartphone. I'm Dave Fettig. I would like to thank our special guest tonight, Naomi Hirahara, plus our listeners. That's you. And without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and information about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and anywhere podcasts can be found. We're going to play a little music for you, and then it's Bonjour, Minnesota. Thank you.